Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
It's no secret that we live in an age in which people are skeptical. People are skeptical of God. People are skeptical about who they are. They're skeptical about whether or not we can trust our senses, whether or not we can tell whether a baby is a boy or a girl, whether or not a family is between a man and a woman and their progeny. We're skeptical about whether or not we can trust what we see on the internet. Perhaps it's AI. Perhaps it's produced by something that isn't even human. Skepticism is something which is sort of rife in our materialist, secularizing world. And most fundamentally, we live in a culture that's skeptical about God. Charles Taylor, in his book, A Secular Age, announced the question, why was it in the year 1500 it was hard not to believe in God, when in the year 2010 or whenever he was writing, it's difficult to believe in God? Why has that 500-year span of time created a kind of skepticism in which we are detached from reality? Well, I propose that skepticism is a very ancient problem and not a new problem. Skepticism is also, on some level, a religious problem. Skepticism is a problem which arises when you do not know who God is. Skepticism is a problem which arises when you do not know what is the cause for the things that you have contact with. When you're detached from God, well, then what do you think everything comes from? Something like chance? Where does the world come from? The world actually has less and less intelligibility the more you think that the world does not have an intelligent cause. And thus, Christianity has been the greatest antidote to skepticism. That being said, prior to Christianity, there was a very elite club who were anti-skeptical. If we think about the pre-Socratics, the pre-Socratics were philosopher who were looking for the causes of things. And where did they look to the causes of things? They looked to what they thought was elemental in the world, right? They thought that maybe everything that existed found its cause in something elemental to what exists. So perhaps fire, the form of fire, was what produced everything. Or maybe it was something like air, or earth, or something like the molecules which constitute the life of water. At some point, materialists began to think that there might be some sort of divine spark in all of these material forms, some sort of notion that all the material forms have within them a divine intelligence. But if you have divine intelligence infused in those kind of particles, those sort of forms of matter which have produced the world, then isn't God just something like part of the world? God is just in the world. And then do you really have any sort of sense, any sort of notion that, do you have any sort of notion of God as being something other than the world? God then is just part of the world. And this is precisely what Socrates decries. Socrates thinks that this actually clouded the mind, that the pre-Socratic philosophers were not actually able to think of anything outside of their world, right? And so they were trapped like billiard balls on a table. They could not get outside. They could not, in their minds, transcend the material world. All they could do was imagine some spark of divine intelligence in the world. Socrates, in the voice of Plato, well, Socrates says there's a way out of this, right? Socrates says the way out of this is that one must purify the mind, right? So Socrates thinks the mind is actually not capable of getting outside of its enclosed, to borrow Charles Taylor's terms, imminent frame, to get off the billiard ball table, is not capable of getting out off that billiard ball table to transcend unless the life is purified, right? So Socrates creates a revolution in philosophy, which says, in order for your mind to be cleansed, you have to cleanse your life. You actually have to live a form of life that is good. You have to live the good life. And if you live the disciplines and the habits of a good life, that will begin to clarify your mind, and you will no longer be trapped in the imminent frame. And if you are no longer trapped in the imminent frame, you will be able to see the cause of all things, right? Plato, of course, is the figure who brings Socrates' wisdom to us. And Plato, in his voice, explores the pre-Socratic question. The pre-Socratic question, of course, is looking for the causes of things, right? And the pre-Socratic question is really looking for what does everything have in common, right? Well, because they were materialists and they couldn't escape this world, they couldn't have an extrinsic standard for judging, all they could do is look to different elements and wonder if everything that we have in common with all existing things is one of these four elements. Socrates and Plato say, well, actually, no. Fire, water, air, these are not really things everything that exists have in common. What does everything that exists have in common? Did anybody know the answer? Go ahead. It exists. The only thing that everything that exists has in common is existence, right? And this was a revolutionary turn. A revolutionary turn, so revolutionary that Augustine thinks it's almost inspired by God, right? Augustine will think this is almost metaphysical realism that's about to emerge in the philosophical scene. Augustine thinks is something very, very special in human history, right? And it is. The birth of the first academy in Athens, the idea that there is something that everything has, that everything has in common is existence, and then one can ask the question properly. What causes existence? And the answer, of course, for Plato is that there is an uncaused cause for existence. And that uncaused cause, that first cause of existence, has as its nature and essence existence itself. And so arriving at some transcendent standard for what causes the world immediately breaks a kind of immanent frame for the ancient world. The ancient world is also stuck in an immanent frame that they cannot get out of. Now, that doesn't make them entirely skeptical, as later radical skeptics will be, but it does create a problem that is in part solved by the first Athenian school. So skepticism then is not a modern or a uniquely modern problem. And In the days leading up to Augustine's baptism, in a philosophical discussion with friends at an estate near Lake Como, Keshakiakum, Saint Augustine, before he becomes baptized, he engages in a series of philosophical disputes. And one of his philosophical disputes, one of the more important philosophical disputes he engages in, is called Contra Academicos. Contra Academicos means against the academicians, but what that really means is against the academicians of the second and third academy. Now, I have to tell you a little bit about ancient Athens in order to tell you what Augustine argues about the ancient academicians of the second and third academy. The first academy establishes a kind of metaphysical realism in which God is the first cause, the uncaused cause of all that is. He's he who is raised beyond all things. It's essentially the same as what God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And Plato agrees that God is being itself. And if God is the transcendent cause of all being, raised high beyond all things, as St. Thomas says in his great prayer before study, then the world has its existence and it has its very intelligibility from an extrinsic cause. Right? The world is charged now with meaning, even philosophically speaking. But this metaphysical realism, which works in different ways for Plato than it does for Aristotle, and we can talk about that, but the metaphysical realism grounds them in this sense that truth can be known from the things which have been made, right? As St. Paul says at the opening of his letter to the Romans, right? We can know about the things of God from the things which have been made. Now, that's a radically anti-skeptical claim, right? That we can know the highest invisible things from the things which have been made. We can know conceptual, invisible things from the perceptual, visible realities. Now, this extraordinary human achievement, an achievement that I don't think was the result of divine supernatural revelation, though one could argue about a natural revelation, declined, shall we say. The second and third academies declined into a kind of radical and then moderate skepticism. Now, why did they do that? Why did you achieve this extraordinary metaphysical realism thousands of years ago in Athens, in the First Academy, and then it descends into skepticism, right? You would think, well, that shouldn't happen, right? We've achieved this extraordinary kind of realism that we can know the things of God from the things which have been made. In Contra Academicos, Augustine argues against those who hold that everything is a matter of doubt, by which he means all sorts of skeptics, right? And those who can know nothing for certain. Can know nothing for certain. You ever say, it seems to me that. That phrase, of course, it can be innocently meant, but that phrase is precisely what a school of skepticism in the third academy called probabilism. Probabilism was the idea that it's, you want to say, it's raining outside, okay? But if you're a probabilist, you say, it seems to be raining outside. Why would you do that? Because you don't want to be wrong, right? You do not want to be wrong. Augustine thinks that the skeptic is a kind of tragic figure because the First Academy actually loves nothing more than truth. They safeguard truth, right? They even have an idea called keeping the Platonic secret about God, right? You keep the Platonic secret. They protect the truth in the First Academy. And Augustine has this idea that the skeptics are laughable and tragic at the same time, because they want to protect the truth so much they never, ever encounter it. Augustine tells the story of a traveler who looks for his destination. And if a traveler is looking to his destination, he is determined to find it, right? And so Augustine tells the story of two travelers. One who's an aristocrat who travels on his horse, and he is determined to find his destination, but he can't find it on his own. He has to trust other people and ask for directions. Like a typical man, though, he doesn't want to get directions. Or when he does ask for directions, he never quite trusts the directions, right? And so he continues to look for his destination, and Augustine contrasts this traveler with a peasant. And the peasant goes forth actually believing that the destination can be found and believing that people will actually help him to find the destination. Well, guess who arrives at the destination? The poor man who trusts that he can arrive there. It's only the skeptic who thinks he's very sophisticated by doubting everything who never arrives at the destination. And it's for this reason that he thinks that skeptics actually are fantasists. Skeptics are actually, they will act like they disbelieve everything, but no one could really live that way. You couldn't actually live that way. And so Augustine says the most profound level is that the skeptic claims that everything should be doubted, but that they could never really live that way. Because we are rational creatures who are made to know the truth. We're made to arrive at destinations. We're not actually made to doubt everything. We're made to trust. We're made to follow authority. We're made to use our reason to make judgments as to whether things are true or false, not to doubt every claim. And so he regards skepticism as a kind of fancy way of being an enemy of morality, because the skeptic is finally afraid, and finally, it's not just that they're afraid of falling into error, though that's the chief thing he thinks. The second and third academicians are told that the wise man only says true things. Well, if the wise man only says true things, then the wise man must never say something that's erroneous. And if you must never say something erroneous, then you better say, hedge your bets and say, it seems to be. It's probable that. And then you never say anything erroneous. But he says this is actually how the wise man attempts truth by undermining it. Actually, it claims to seek truth, but is never united to truth, never united to wisdom. And it's precisely by being united to wisdom that we can also be good. This alone is what makes the rational soul happy, is by being united to being itself, being united to goodness itself, being united to wisdom itself, being united to truth. So the skeptic is an enemy of both truth and goodness. Augustine never tires of showing that skepticism is always throwing up obstacles before the intellect. And when it throws up obstacles before the intellect, it's also throwing up obstacles for the good life. And thus the skeptic is an enemy of morality, right? And how often do we see this, right? If you make an argument for something that is good in our culture, someone will immediately raise skeptical arguments about whether or not you can even know the premise. Metaphysical realism, on the other hand, asserts what? That reality is intelligible, that you can know what's real, that you can know what's true, that you can know the things of God from the things which have been made, that you can use your reason to arrive at a unity with the truth. A conformity, Thomas would say, of the mind to reality, right? This is a classic Thomistic description of what our minds are made for. Our minds are made to be conformed to reality. Augustine believes that actually the Christian must defeat skepticism. The Christian must defeat skepticism because how can you lead people to Christ, who is the truth, if they actually don't think there is a truth which can be found? If you've already said no, that truth cannot be found, then you can never receive Christ. And this is a massive philosophical argument, obstacle to the faith. And so Augustine set forth before his baptism of removing this obstacle, not only for himself, to his own satisfaction, but to his students and his friends, Alypius, his son, Adeodatus. This standard of metaphysical realism, of course, declined in the second and third academies. Now, when was it taken up again? Well, this is a live question in philosophy and the history of philosophy. One could say that the Peripatetics ended up becoming Roman Stoics. There's arguments for where the first academy realists went after the decline of first academy realism into second and third academy skepticism. But there's a very good argument for saying it didn't appear again until the advent of Jesus Christ. That it isn't until Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh, comes that metaphysical realism takes up its place in Western civilization again. This, of course, finds a premier example in the metaphysical realism of figures like the Church Fathers, such as St. Augustine. But in the 13th century, in the medieval period, we also see a tremendous flowering of metaphysical realism. Now, some of you have studied your medievals, and you know that there is a kind of rebirth of the study of both Plato and Aristotle. Right? And so the First Academy doesn't really get taken up again in a broad cultural way until the 12th and 13th century. The metaphysical realists then of the 13th century, you could say, are refounding the First Academy, right? That without faith, philosophy flounders, right? Philosophy, our natural reason, the light of reason, can get so far, but then it falls back, right? This is what Augustine thinks about Plato's contemplative vision, right? The light of reason can just go up to a vision of God as one, and then falls back down. And that this is what human reason does. Human reason is capable, is capax Dei, is capable of seeing God, but without God's help, it falls back down. Historically, anyways. In the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas and Duns Scotus are two figures who could be taken to figures of a revival of metaphysical realism in the medieval world. Both Aquinas and Scotus, or Bonaventure if you will, saw that the world was intelligible and that it corresponded to heavenly perfections, which they called universals, as did the First Academy. That is to say, whether or not you were on Plato's side with Duns Scotus and Bonaventure, or whether you were on Aristotle's side with Thomas Aquinas and others, what you believed was what Paul proclaimed in Romans 1, that we can know the things of God from the things which have been made. That is to say, on some level, it's Christians who defended philosophy again. The metaphysical realists all believed that the intelligibility of this world was a necessary claim. If there is to be a rational understanding of creation, there must be a rational creator. And indeed, there is a rational way of understanding creation. Both the high Platonic realism of Scotus and the more moderate Aristotelian realism of Aquinas claimed that we could know eternal principles through particulars. Now, a very, very great challenge to this. By the way, How many of you know the difference between Aristotle and Plato and Aquinas and Scotus on analogy? Does anybody know that? One person, two people, three people? Plato thinks that we have a kind of almost conceptual superhighway between God, big B being itself, and little B being the things which have been made. And so the mind can sort of travel on the idea of, say, the goodness of water on up to the very cause of goodness. And the mind can travel on this like a kind of conceptual freeway to God, right? In which you can get gradations of goodness until you reach goodness itself. Aristotle thinks this is too much emanationism, right? And Aristotle thinks, no, God is more dissimilar to us than he is similar to us. And so he predicates that we can say things by analogy. So water is good, but it's not good in the same way that God is good, right? Water is good by some analogy to God's goodness, right? It has some analogy. But that's a major difference between Aristotelians and Platonists. But notice what is common between them. They both think you can know. They both think you can know the heavenly things from the made things, right? That's the commonality between Plato and Aristotle and between Aquinas and the Franciscans. I just said that because we're at Franciscan. So this high Platonic realism, despite some internal disagreements about how we can come to know, have this profound sense that the world is intelligible. But in 1287, a man is born named William of Ockham. Now, William of Ockham is a very, very bright boy. William of Ockham is also someone who wants to out-question the Aristotelians. He's a kind of radical Aristotelian. And he wants to say, you know, Plato's got this superhighway to being. And remember in the image, in the schools of philosophy, Aristotle's right in the middle, right? Ockham wants the hand to be lowered all the way down here, right? Ockham wants to say, oh, Aristotle lowered the bar to here so that we have a kind of moderate view of our realism. And Ockham says, no, let's lower that bar all the way to matter, to the things which have been made, so much so that we don't need to multiply entities beyond necessity. This is the definition that is sometimes better known as Occam's razor. You've heard Occam's razor, right? Sometimes colloquially used to just argue for giving the simplest explanation. But that's not what it means for Occam. Occam's razor is actually demonstrating that you cannot know the universals from the things which have been made. Ockham attempts to obliterate metaphysical realism by a denial of universals altogether. Ockham's famous razor, don't multiply entities beyond necessity, is a way of saying, don't make up make-believes that you can't see, right? That you don't know, that you can't touch. This was intended to cut especially the particular off from its correspondence to universals. Ockham introduced the idea of hechicitas, right? Of thisness. Everything depends on the thisness of a particular. No longer can I think about some idea about water, some universal, some goodness that might inhere in the water. Now I can only think about the water. The particularity, not even of water in general, but the particularity of this bottle of water. Having rejected universals, all that remained for Ockham was particulars and how we name them, how we nomen them in Latin, right? And from this we get nominalism, right? So Occam introduces something that we will now call a philosophical foundation of naming, a nominalism. Having rejected universals, all we have are the names that we give to things. And we're back on the billiard ball table. We're back in the immanent frame, in which things only have intelligibility according to the names that we give them. This was actually quite radical. It's a new constructivist metaphysics. No longer is the world intelligible through some extrinsic cause or through some intrinsic correspondence. But now we have a way of understanding that the individual alone exists as one who names particular things. The individual can name resemblances between things. I can say that Peter looks similar to Paul. I can say that Paul looks similar to John. But since there are no universals, can I say that they share in a common human nature? No, I cannot. I can say that I see resemblances between them that I could call a common human nature, but there's no such thing as a common human nature. In other words, common human nature is a kind of convenient conceptual fiction that I apply through my observation of resemblances between Peter and Paul and John. An illustration of nominalism that's often given is paper currency. Right? Nobody has paper currency anymore, so it's probably not the best analogy, but maybe it is. The paper on which a $5 bill and a $100 bill are printed is the same, right? It's exactly the same. But what is the paper? Almost nothing, right? It's worth almost nothing. Or you could say, it's worth only what we say it is worth. Right? There is no intrinsic worth in the paper. The paper is almost nothing. The only thing that matters about the currency is what we say about it. Now, this is actually perfectly true about paper currency, right? Fiat currency. The nominalist thinks, however, that this is how reality works. The nominalist will say that John and Peter have some resemblances between them, but they cannot be said to partake of a common human nature. Common human nature is just a philosophical conceptual framework that we give to naming resemblances we observe. In this sense, we've actually done exactly what the First Academy experienced. The First Academy descended into the skepticism of the Second and Third Academy, and the high medieval realism of the 13th century descends into a 14th century nominalist skepticism about reality. It's a profound skepticism. In some ways, it's even more profound than our kind of messy skepticism today. So what comes after Occam? Well, does anybody know who trained Luther in philosophy? Nominalists. Luther only knew nominalist philosophy. He did not ever read any Thomistic philosophy. Never. He thought he knew that there were Aristotelians who disagreed with Occam, but he did not himself ever encounter metaphysical realists or their arguments. He only encountered what nominalists said about metaphysical realists. And, of course, they said that they multiply complexities. They multiply distinctions that are fictional. Luther considered himself to be, because he was very modest, he considered himself to be the greatest nominalist. And in some ways, he was, because he followed it to its logical conclusion. He decided as the greatest nominalist, that philosophy was a whore of Babylon. Right? It was just constructivism. It was just making things up. And that the only way we could know anything was by divine revelation. Right? And so Occam is the first, he's the first fideist, really, of the modern world. He's the first one who actually denies the capacity of reason to know God from the things which have been made, to deny a metaphysical realism, and the first to say we can only really know things by faith or by the names that we give things. And so from Luther's post-nominalist, from Occam to Luther's post-nominalist protest in the 16th century, is it any surprise that we get to Kant? Is it any surprise that we go from this profound skepticism of nominalism as a constructivist metaphysics that was designed to destroy metaphysical realism to the sola fide of Martin Luther, to the so-called enlightenment of Kant? Luther's rejection of philosophy and Kant's rejection of our intellectual capacity to know the invisible God through the things which have been made are direct descendants of the reduction of thought started with Occam. Immanuel Kant is rightly seen, 1724 to 1804, obligatory to say his dates, rightly seen as the father of modern thought. We should remember that his thought was largely made possible by Occam. Kant's revolution in philosophy was very much aligned with Occam's, if more sophisticated. Rather than a nominalist conventionalism about naming, Kant argued that human understanding is the source of all of our knowledge of ideas. And that follows, right? If you have a constructivist metaphysics, it makes sense, actually, that you would begin to think along these lines, that human understanding is the source of all of our knowledge about the general laws of nature. If human understanding is the source of all of our knowledge, then any sort of argument for God's existence would be some sort of circular reduction, right? We'd be talking about ourselves writ large. While the Catholic Occam still believed that God reveals the moral law by divine decree, Kant believed that the moral law comes to us by way of reason alone. Most important for our purposes is to see that Kant famously denies traditional demonstrations of God's existence by necessity. He must do that along these constructivist nominalist lines. Now, classical metaphysical realism is indeed the enemy. Is impossible to think. Why is it impossible to think about God in 2000 where it was easy in 1500? Well, part of the answer is Kant. Part of the answer is Occam. Cutting us off, cutting reason off from knowledge of God, cutting reason off from knowledge of God is what inevitably creates a skeptical culture. Kant's rejection of the ontological argument of St. Anselm is similar to objections which had been made by St. Thomas himself. Anselm had argued, of course, that even one who did not believe in God could at least agree that it was possible to conceive of the existence of nothing greater, the existence of something greater than which exists. Let's see. It was greater to exist in reality than in the mind only, Anselm says, and therefore only the fool must admit that God must exist in reality and not only as a concept. Kant says that the ontological argument is circular because it includes the judgment that God exists in the presence, in the premise that God is that than which nothing greater can be thought. There's the sentence I was looking for. Since the concept of existence is utterly derived from our own experience of the world on nominalist terms, Kant thinks that it doesn't deliver our understanding to the transcendent reality, but only to our creaturely concept of existence. So we can think about the idea of existence, but we really can never arrive at anything other than our concept. It's derived from ourselves, and it ends in ourselves. Man is the measure of all things, and then man becomes the end of all things. Kant similarly dismisses the cosmological argument, the argument from contingency, necessity. He admires arguments from design, such as St. Thomas's teleological argument in the Fifth Way, but he doesn't think that any of these actually truly bring the mind to knowledge of God as creator. It only brings the mind to God as a concept that is trapped in human experience. Not nominalist in the strictest sense, Kant nevertheless is a kind of skeptic about God in much the same way. He effectively argues that there are no demonstrations of God's existence which can ever escape our categories, and therefore we cannot know the things of God from the things which have been made. The mind is fugitive, orphaned, detached from God, necessarily. Kant does not think the natural intellect can know anything really true about God. Kant, however, does believe that there's a transcending experience that we can have. For example, if I look at a picture of a man and a woman on a mantle, and the woman's wearing a wedding dress and the man is wearing a tuxedo, I can have a transcending experience for a moment and think, oh, that's a wedding. Oh, I can think that's marriage. Oh, I can think that's love. Those are transcending experiences that human beings can have. And that these transcending dimensions, which we experience all the time, are, in a sense, the only way in which we can glimpse God. We can glimpse that there is an experience of our transcendence. There is a transcending experience of transcending phenomena. And that whenever we have this transcending experience, we are getting a feeling for God, right? And so with Kant, you begin to deny that reason can know God, but what can know God for Kant? Feeling. The feeling of transcendence. Not unlike Occam, Kant is a skeptic in his philosophy and a pietist in his theology. Right? Theology is now going to be rooted in feeling, not reason. And philosophy is going to be attenuated by a certain kind of skepticism about what the mind can know. Kant's view is really that God is so transcendent as to be inaccessible to us. So in the name of radical transcendence for God, he actually denies that the mind can know it, but that our feeling, Gefühl in the German, this will come to a kind of pinnacle in Schleiermacher. If you know Schleiermacher, the great Protestant theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher thinks that Christianity is a matter of feeling, of experience, right? Evangelicalism is charged with this. Pietism is charged with this. Charismatic movements are charged with this, spiritualism. And Kant is too, and so is Schleiermacher. Feuerbach, has anyone read Ludwig Feuerbach, The Essence of Christianity? Feuerbach draws the correct conclusion. If that's the case, if all this is the case, then our vision of God, the essence of Christianity, is just a big picture of ourselves, right? We're just projecting our feelings onto God. So if God is so transcendent for Kant as to be inaccessible to reason, well, there must be some counterpoint to that, and that comes with Hegel. Hegel, of course, argues something like the opposite, right? Hegel argues that God is radically immanent. God's radically near. But where is God radically near? Not in the individual experience, but in historical experience. Right? God is radically near us in the unfolding of human history. God is known to us not by reason, not by the conformity of the mind to reality, as Thomas Aquinas will say, but now with Hegel, God is known to us in and through the communal experience of time, history. As a response to Kant's rationalism, Hegel dialectically both accepts and rejects Kant's infinitely transcendent God, even as he dialectically accepts and rejects the romantic subjectivity which flowed from it. Where Kant might lead to an individualistic and pietistic conclusion concerning our knowledge of God by religious feeling, Hegel argued that the best argument for God, again, is not by reason from the things which have been made, but the best argument from God is actually in the study of tradition, the study of culture, the study of history, right? Sometimes Hegel's looked to as a more conservative figure for that reason, right? For Hegel, God is absolute, and Christianity is absolute religion. He's not denying the truth of Christianity, but that we know God through a process of God coming to greater fulfillment in time. The absolute or universal moves out of himself to the historically particular through a kenotic movement in which God pours out his life for a common people by a Geist to a Sittlichkeit, a moral community. And this way, all of history is the unfolding of the knowledge of God. Hegel universalized this as an idealist philosophy and transformed, actually, lots of Christian claims into secular ones. Hegel does not see God as the true font of light and wisdom, nor does he see God as the primal origin raised high beyond all things. Because in the most dramatic way possible, Hegel reacts to the radical transcendence of Kant with the radical immanence of God. Hegel believes that God is indeed not God without the world. And that actually comes very, very close to the pre-Socratic materialists, right? In which God is actually just like the soul of the world, the divine spark. To some, especially Protestant theologians, it would seem that Hegel was saving Christian theology from the rationalism of the Enlightenment. Charles Taylor, in his book Secular Age and also in his book on Hegel, considered Hegel to be the original death of God theologian. Citing a Lutheran hymn called God Himself is Dead, Hegel argues that God unites death to his nature. This is so radical that whenever we encounter suffering and death, Hegel says, we can say that we taste the particularities of the eternal divine. Any kind of experience you have is a taste of God. As Hegel puts it, this is not a single act, but the eternal divine history. It is a moment in the nature of God himself. It has taken place in God himself. In other words, everything in history is taking place in God. This, my friends, is the immanent frame also, which you cannot escape. And this leads to a profound skepticism as well, a skepticism about God as indeed the Trinity as being nothing other than the passage of time, right? The progress of time. And so with Hegel, we get something like historical progressivism. With Hegel, we get the idea that history is on this beautiful flight path towards revealing more and more and more of God. A view that history is progressive. This, of course, leads us to no other place than to say that just what the constructivism of Occam said, which is that it's the community that decides progress. It's the community that decides what is real. It's the community that constructs reality. This, my friends, is the skepticism that we live in today. We live in a skepticism in which everybody gets to say what they think constructs reality. We live in a world in which we say that reality is not something that is intrinsically intelligible, but can only receive the meaning that we give to it. It's a little bit like the French existentialists, like the myth of Sisyphus from Camus, where you have to push the stone up the hill, and you are the one who must import the meaning to things, rather than the meaning of things being intrinsic. And so the skepticism that we experience today is really both a metaphysical problem and a theological problem. These things go together because, indeed, without God's help, philosophy can't do its job. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.